You're listening to another episode of the Young Investors Podcast, so sit back and relax as myself, Brandon, and my buddy Hamish discuss the latest in the world of finance and stock market investing. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing and you need some help, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with all that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast. Hey guys, welcome back. Welcome back to another episode. Hamish Hotter, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
How's things in Melbourne going?
Yeah, going well. Nothing new to report. Just same old, same old. Less COVID this week than last week. So it tends to be something I watch week by week as we come around to the podcast, something to talk about. How's things in Canberra with zero cases?
Zero cases. To be honest, I am gobsmacked that we still have zero cases. Considering, I mean, we must be really tight on not letting anyone from Sydney into Canberra. Yeah, remarkable. But I guess somehow we've still got no cases, so I'm happy with that. I'm just over it. I know I've said this before, but I'm not even paying attention to the news anymore. I don't even know what's happening in Melbourne or South Australia, Queensland, or anywhere with COVID. I just don't want to look at it anymore because it just makes me sad.
Yeah, I don't watch the news anymore. The only news I watch is some finance related news, of course, related to businesses. But yeah, anything outside of that, I usually find out well after the event has actually happened. But I mean, there's a little bit going on in the finance world at the moment. We've got earnings season that's kind of been chugging along for what, 2 or 3 weeks now. We're starting to get some 13F filings coming out where big investors are reporting what trades they made in the previous quarter. Yeah. So that's starting to kind of trickle out. I've got a couple of stories on that today. I mean, there's just a number of other things going on as well. A lot coming out of China that'll take us through today as well.
Yeah, sounds good. Should we get stuck into it?
Yeah, absolutely. So today's episode is sponsored by ShareSite, which is an application you can use to track the performance of your stock portfolio. So basically, you can pull in all of your trades either manually if you want to or automatically by connecting it to your broker. And it will give you an accurate snapshot of the performance of your portfolio over time. So it will track your capital gains, it'll track your dividends, it'll track your dividend reinvestment plans, and currency gains. Currency gains is super important. Most people don't track their currency, particularly if you're buying shares internationally or you just hold foreign currencies. It can make a big difference. Probably a much bigger difference than you would expect. As I've mentioned on a couple of episodes, for a 12-month period from parts of 2020 into 2021, some of my positions in my portfolio were down 10% on currency alone, which is crazy, right? That could wipe out the entire gain for a particular business that you think is, you know, tracking with the index. So following currency is super important, and it's very difficult to do if you don't have something like ShareSite. But then the main reason why I've personally been using ShareSite over the past 3 or 4 years is for when it comes to tax time. So ShareSite generates up to 10 different reports that can be used at tax time to work out things such as your capital gains, dividend income, and more. At the moment, you can try ShareSite for free by heading over to ShareSite.com/Young Investors. That's site spelled S-I-G-H-T, ShareSite.com/Young Investors. So use that link, sign up to a free plan. You can track up to 10 holdings, I believe, forever. So you can just try it forever. Or if you want to sign up to a premium plan and get access to more reporting and some other features, then you can use that link and get 4 months off a yearly subscription. So go check it out if you're interested. And once again, thanks to everyone who has used that link when signing up to ShareSite and is supporting the podcast.
Mm. You know, last night, I forgot to mention this. Have you seen Tim Dodd, the Everyday Astronaut?
No,
I haven't. You haven't seen his channel? Oh, great channel. But I was up late last night and I saw this new Elon Musk interview with Tim Dodd. And man, it is so crazy. I thought I'd mention it because you might find it interesting. The interview is basically Tim Dodd getting inside access to Starbase, the facility they're building, the SpaceX facility in Texas. Wow. And he just goes around. He essentially walks around with Elon Musk and they just geek out on rockets, which is amazing. But I tell you what, I was blown away just watching Elon Musk's mind just bounce around, and he was answering so many really technical questions on the rocket and like the grid fins and the, you know, thrust and the different, how they build the different engines. I was so like, I would definitely recommend people go check it out. I mean, the reason that this is relevant for investors is because watching that interview and how technical Elon got about every single part of the rocket just shows me that like Elon is a CEO that is totally like on the front lines. He knows everything about his product. He is the engineer, the head engineer of the rocket. You know, he is on the ground in Texas helping with production. I mean, how many CEOs actually go that in depth? I mean, I feel like most CEOs, they spend their whole day just behind a computer, just tap, tap, tapping away, answering calls, you know, sending emails. But man, this is, I really admire Elon Musk as a CEO because he's spoken about leading from the front lines before. And man, that interview just showed that, yeah, he is really on the front line of this company. It was just crazy, really crazy.
Yeah, I think a lot of people get caught up with things like that, you know, Elon like basically bought Tesla. He wasn't the actual original founder. People get caught up on that and think, oh, he's just this rich guy who just bought businesses and got lucky in a way. But then you watch an interview, like I'm sure that interview, I haven't seen it, but I've seen other ones where he goes really technical and you just realize that, man, he's on another level of understanding, particularly when it comes to things like engineering. So it's crazy. I have a lot of respect for Elon Musk and what he's done for a lot of businesses. So I'll have to check that one out.
Yeah. It also just totally, all of those articles where you hear reporters or people saying, what you're saying, Elon Musk is just like some rich front guy for the company. He doesn't actually know what he's talking about when it comes to rockets. Man, if you watch that interview, you'll realize that, nope, he really knows everything about the rocket that he is about to launch. It was a very, very good interview. I mean, super technical. So much stuff just flew over my head. Like, I don't understand what they're talking about half the time. But just such a cool interview. Anyway, sorry, that was a little anecdote, not really a news story or anything. So let's move on. Where should we start? Do you want to talk about what you've been looking at with the Chinese tech and what's going on over in China?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that have kind of come out this week in relation to China that I wanted to talk about. But in looking into those things, I realized that this has been something, well, what's been happening in China in terms of businesses has been going on for quite a while now over the past year. And I found a really good article that kind of went through and gave quite a good timeline as well as kind of breaking down some of the major things that are going on just so that we can understand what's happening. And then I'll progress into some of the more investing related stuff that happened this week and that we found out this week, particularly in terms of some guru investors, some successful investors who are making some moves in China. But basically the Chinese government over the past year or so has been really cracking down on businesses in a lot of different ways. They've implemented a very wide variety of very significant regulatory changes, particularly over the past couple of weeks. So there's a lot that's been going on. You can dive really deep into this stuff. And there's obviously a lot of smaller changes that have impacts that are not so obvious on the surface and that sort of thing. But some of the major things that have been happening, so Chinese tech companies such as Alibaba and Tencent have been targeted for antitrust probes. So the Chinese government's been looking into these businesses and really assessing, you know, whether they've been acting in anti-competitive ways. In a lot of ways, you know, the US government has been doing the same thing for US businesses. It's kind of, over the past couple of years, been really in the forefront of both governments' minds that these businesses are massive. They've grown in a huge way. We've got to make sure that they're not doing anything crazy or anything that, you know, is anti-competitive. They also made a number of changes in terms of data security regulations. So that's obviously a big thing in China. Talk about that in a second. And then they have also made some just outright bans that basically halted entire industries in China, which is kind of crazy. So There's a lot, but just to give you kind of a summary, and so we don't have to kind of talk on this for too long, and there is I do want to talk about the Guru Investor specifically, but yeah. In terms of the antitrust probes, these have been going on for about a year. Alibaba was fined in April of this year, $2.8 billion, which was the biggest fine handed down
in China, I remember that.
I believe. Yeah, so
I think it might have been the biggest full stop. Has there been a bigger fine in the US? For antitrust, I'm not sure.
That's a good point. There's definitely been bigger fines. Facebook copped, I think, an $8 billion fine or something from the EU, but that wasn't in relation to antitrust. So,
I feel like I remember the headlines. I wish I knew now. I feel like I remember the headlines saying this is the biggest antitrust fine ever, or maybe it was ever handed down by the Chinese government. Yeah. Anyway, it was big.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that was, you know, a couple of months ago, as I mentioned, but these probes have been ongoing, and there's a lot of concern right now that there's going to be more fines coming for other businesses like Tencent, or other just court orders, just businesses being forced to not operate in a certain way or to stop operating altogether. And then in terms of data security, so China, of course, is known for wanting to maintain a firm grip on two things, really. First of all, what data people in China have access to from businesses outside of China, but then also what data leaves China through private businesses. So that's been a major focus for China for an extremely long period of time. One business in particular was hit hard with this month. So Didi, which is kind of an competitor to Uber, a ride-hailing service. China, earlier this month, well, first of all, at the start of July, they IPO'd in the United States. So that was a big move for them. I think they grabbed a $100 billion valuation or something insane. And then 2 days later, China suspended the app in China. So,
brutal.
I mean, that's just an example of, I believe they didn't give much information according to the article of why they did it specifically, except that Didi had mishandled data for some of their Chinese users. So as a result, the app was just suspended, which is kind of crazy that something like that can happen so quickly. But it did, and the stock was down massively after the IPO. Then they've done a few other things. So the article spoke about the government having this aim to cut the cost of living. And the way that they go about doing that is by really at the expense of businesses, just changing regulations in significant ways that either prevent businesses from doing certain things or just outright banning them. An example of this was that last week, China banned for-profit tutoring in core education. So you can't run a for-profit business anymore in tutoring, in education.
That's rough.
And if you don't really look into the education industry in China, it is massive. This is a huge industry. Particularly, there's a lot of online tutoring businesses for things like English, where I know that there's a number of Australian companies that provide basically online tutoring to kids in China. So there'll be kids in a classroom in China, or even one-on-one that log on to online tutoring. That's all banned now as of last week.
Wow.
Which is kind of crazy when you think about it, right? Just no warning, a ban on that.
I think it just shows you how different the political how different the government works in China than places like Australia or the US. I mean, the Chinese government really does just have ultimate power. They pretty much just do, I guess, what they like, which is clearly evident here. I mean, imagine if something like this happened in the States. There'd be companies suing the government or taking them, trying to get compensated for the change in the laws and yada, yada. But
yeah. And we would hear about, like, because laws take so long to pass in the United States. So we always hear about, you know, the speculation that these laws are, you know, maybe coming, and then, you know, the Democrats write up a bill and they present the bill, and then they try and get it through the lower house, and then there's some revisions, and then they try and get it through the upper. So there's a whole process, right? And that process just doesn't take place in China. So sometimes you get these changes that just happen so quickly.
Crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. And the only other major thing I wanted to talk about in terms of regulatory changes was there was a state media story that came out this week that likened internet gaming to opium addiction. So basically to heroin addiction. So that was a big kind of story this week in that there wasn't actually any regulatory change, but because it was presented by a state media outlet, many believe, or a lot of investors got scared that gaming companies are kind of going to be in the next wave of regulations or bans. So,
wow.
It's a very, I would say, unstable environment right now for investors in China who are just kind of looking around, hoping they're not the next industry to get hit, or hoping that they don't get hit too hard. But in terms of Chinese stocks broadly, you have the CSI 300 index, which represents the 300 biggest businesses on the Shanghai index. That's down 18% from its February peak of this year. But specific businesses are down way worse. So Tencent is down 40% since February. And Alibaba is down 35% from October of last year was when it peaked. So, yeah.
I find that interesting because those two companies are enormous, right? And they're like very important to the Chinese economy. So the way I always think about government imposing rules and blah, 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 is that the government can, I guess, let's say they can do what they like, but if they have the power to do what they like, then they have to also live with the consequences of what they do. Whereas if you, for example, if they, I don't know, we can even think about a situation here in Australia, you know, if Australia imposed some sort of big rule that inhibited business because we think business is wrong or something, then ultimately the Australian government might be able to do something like that. But then they've also got to live with the consequences that, okay, now if they inhibit business, they won't collect as much revenue, tax revenue from those businesses. So then the government's got less money to work with. So actually, and obviously the bigger the company, you know, the more, generally speaking, you know, the more tax it contributes, the more important it is to that country. So I find it interesting that, you know, people are running away from companies like Tencent and Alibaba, which I would imagine have quite a significant place in the Chinese economy.
Yeah. And I mean, I'll be the first to put my hand up and say that, you know, I understand a sliver of what's going on. What's the name of this article? I recommend some people check this out. It's called China's Big Tech Crackdown, A Guide. So that was kind of what I was going through. And they went on to talk about how China has this strategy of kind of consolidating their economy and how businesses run into certain industries that they deem important, and cutting out and regulating in areas that they seem less important, particularly areas such as consumer related businesses that are serving people outside of China. I don't know, you know, as I said, I know a very sliver of this. I don't invest in China because I know so little about this, but it is interesting to kind of see how a different government kind of operates things and the way they go about it.
True. It's very different. Very different.
It is. And I mean, speaking of China and Alibaba in particular, that's kind of where I wanted to segue into, you know, the investing related part of this, which is that we have two new big fund managers who have invested in Alibaba, that being Phil Town and Guy Spear. We have some 13F filings that revealed two new positions in Alibaba. And most of these 13F filings will be getting, what, in 2 weeks, I think?
Yeah.
Around the 14th or 15th of August, which is 45 days after the end of the period. So that's typically when we get most of these 13F filings, but sometimes we get them a little bit earlier, and that has been the case for a couple of funds, and particularly for Phil Town and Guy Spear. They've made some investments in Alibaba. This, of course, comes after Charlie Munger invested last quarter, and Monish Pabrai also invested in Alibaba. So
true.
Everyone's kind of piling in.
It is the Alibaba trend amongst super investors at the moment, isn't it? You're right. Yeah. Charlie Munger was the first, and then he triggered, when I say triggered, that's not right, because all these guys do their own independent thinking. but that was, I feel like that was definitely a reason why Monish Pabrai looked into Alibaba, and then he liked what he saw and he bought it. And yeah, now it's trickled down to Guy Spier, who I probably could have guessed because Guy Spier is extremely close with Monish Pabrai. However, Phil Town is one where you could have guessed because it obviously follows, you know, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger style investing. That is very interesting. Phil Town in on Alibaba.
Yeah, well, ooh. I mean, on Guy Spier, I was looking at his portfolio just before, and it's almost identical to the Berkshire portfolio. In fact, he has 25% of his portfolio in Berkshire. He then holds some Daily Journal Corporation, which is what Charlie Munger manages. Alibaba he holds, and then he holds, I think, American Express and Bank of America. So, I mean,
which are big Berkshire Hathaway stocks,
aren't
they? Yeah,
so his portfolio is very much looks like a cloning portfolio in a way of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. Phil Town a little bit out of left field, I think, for me. One thing on Phil Town's portfolio, it's very difficult, I found, to find the Rule 1 filing for their portfolio. So I'd recommend you check out Investing with Tom, who did a video breakdown on it. I'm not sure if you saw that video yet, but he did a breakdown on Phil's portfolio, and he did all of the grunt work in terms of figuring out what changes were made during the period. So I recommend you check out that video if you're interested. But that filing basically revealed that Phil Town has put 4.4% of his portfolio into Alibaba, worth around $5.9 million. And the only other significant change Phil Town made was he also put 4.5% into an organic grocery chain called Sprouts Farmers Market. So those were the two changes that Phil Town made. Guy Spier put 5% of his portfolio into Alibaba and then 1.8% into Daily Journal Corporation. Pretty interesting move. It's funny.
There is a trend. There is a trend to Alibaba, isn't there?
It's funny to see this because if this happened between like a group of much lower level investors who were all kind of relatively friends, you would just think that people are not doing their research and just copying the first person who went in, like Charlie Munger in this case. Like it kind of, you know what I mean? Like if they didn't all have a reputation for being really successful investors with good track records, then you would just think that like everyone's just copying Charlie Munger.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
It's like Charlie Munger's sitting at the front of the class doing the test, and then the guy sitting to his right has copied his paper. Then the guy sitting behind has got a little sneak peek of the answer and has copied that.
Yeah. And I mean,
no, you're absolutely right. It does just look, I mean, in all honesty, they definitely are copying each other. Like, they're definitely, I reckon along the way, you know, Monish Pabrai says he's a shameless cloner. Like, he loves to clone. So they are copying in a sense, but they're not copying. They're not just going, okay, I'm investing in Alibaba because Charlie Munger did. What they're doing is they're watching what Charlie Munger does. In some instances, they might actually be talking with Charlie Munger. And then from there, they go, oh, okay, you know, I might go and check out Alibaba. Then they go and do their own research, make sure they can understand the business, make sure they think it's a good investment. And then if that happens, then they buy in. So, yes, they are cloning, but they're not simply copying without actually doing their due diligence, because that's what we always say with 13F filings. I mean, I love 13F filings because you get to see what all the big investors are doing, but we don't copy what they're doing just because they're doing it. We use that as like a guiding light, or really like an ideas list of companies that you might be interested in exploring further. Yeah.
The interesting thing about Phil Towns' investment, and Tom spoke about this in his video, was that Phil Town, I think 2 weeks ago, made a video on YouTube about all the dangers of investing in China. And
right.
I mean, one of the major points he made was that there's a lot of dodgy accounting that goes on in China, and that you know, you have to be very careful of fraudulent balance sheets and income statements.
Okay.
And that in that video, I think he put Alibaba in a category where he basically said in the video, this is what Tom said at least, that you know, if you're investing in China, you want to be able to like kick the tires. Like, you need to have like some kind of relationship or inside know that the accounting is solid. So I guess Phil Town thinks that he has that kind of know, or maybe as an extension of Charlie Munger, he just assumes that you know, the accounting is final or whatever. But is interesting. I'm not particularly interested in Alibaba, I'll be honest. I might take another look at it, but you know, it's a business that, as I in China, in an area that I know so little about, and it's a very complicated business as well. I think not an area I'm amazingly passionate about. I am kind of interested, honestly, in Phil Town's other investment in his grocery chain. I've looked at a number of grocery chains in the US over the past right. few months. So I am actually a little bit more interested in that business, funnily enough. So I might check that out. But
what was it?
Sprouts Farmers Market.
Okay.
So I think it's supposed to be, is the biggest competitor to Whole Foods, but at a much lower cost. Whole Foods is extremely expensive. And it's a, yeah.
And that was acquired by Amazon, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah. So it's now owned right. by Amazon. Yeah.
Yep.
But yeah, it's a pretty small grocery chain. I think they have 200 or 300 stores across the US. They're trying to grow to 600 or so over the next 10 years. So yeah. Interesting.
It's probably just trying to be another Whole Foods, really.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I think,
exactly,
and right. I believe Phil Town invested in Whole Foods, or I remember that was in the book Invested that he wrote with Danielle Town.
Right.
So, or maybe it was Danielle that invested in there. So I feel like that's kind of in line with a similar investment he's made in the past with the Whole Foods stuff. So maybe that's just a part of his circle of competence, and he's attracted to those kind of healthy grocery kind of outlets. But to be honest, I've never heard, like, not living in America, I've never heard of this this grocery thing, but interesting, might be worth a little look into.
Where do you want to go from here?
I think we should talk about Robinhood's IPO,
because
this is just funny. I mean, you can probably, honestly, we've spoken about a fair few IPOs in the past year or so, and the story's always the same, and no change with Robinhood's IPO. You can probably guess exactly what we're going to say when it comes to Robinhood's IPO, which is kind of funny. So, but anyway, yes, Robinhood, they did get through their IPO. They launched as HOOD, tick symbol HOOD, on the NASDAQ, as they were hoping. And so the stock opened on Thursday at $38 per share. So people were surprised, because that was the low end of the offering range.
Right.
And then, so $38 per share is where they launched this thing. And then it fell 8% on the first day. Yeah. And then, it, you know, it traded largely below that, you know, that price until Tuesday, when it rallied.
Oh.
And it rallied hard, rallied 24%. So that was on Tuesday. And then Robinhood shares again soared yesterday on Wednesday. This it says here in the CNBC article, the volatile stock surpassed its IPO debut volume of 102.5 million shares, trading over 104.6 million shares on Wednesday. Uh-huh. The stock closed up 50.4% to $70.39 per share, bringing its weekly gain to more than 100%.
Wow.
Says here, shares of Robinhood touched $85 at one point, an 81% gain from Tuesday's close. But I think, yeah, it closed up 54% at $70.39. Oh, golly gee.
My goodness.
I mean, this is the thing. You toss a coin. IPOs, what's going to happen? They're going to surge you know, 100% or they're going to flop. What's the case we're talking about, the IPO that flopped?
Coinbase? Did Coinbase flop?
Coinbase. That's right. Coinbase. That was the one.
Yeah.
It literally, and speaking of coins, it literally is like you're tossing a coin with IPOs. That's why I just don't, it's just so hard to predict what's going on.
Yeah, you tried to get me to make a prediction on this, I think. I can't remember if I did or not. Did you make a prediction about what it would do after it opened?
I can't remember.
I think you
now.
I remember me pushing.
Yeah, I remember us doing that.
Yeah.
Man, my memory's bad.
Yeah, I know. My memory's shocking. I don't even know which episode that was on, but I don't think I said either way. I said I just didn't know, I think.
Did you say you probably refused to put a number on it or something?
Yeah, something like that. I don't know.
Probably because I was just trying to get you to say something. But yeah, there we go, hey.
Yeah, crazy. What's the what's the market cap? What's their share price on a whole basis?
Current market cap $58 billion.
Oh, get out of here. Get out of here with that valuation.
I know. Man, I'd pay more for Hometown International.
Oh, let's see how Hometown International's doing. What was it at? It was at 100 million.
Was it 100? Oh, 100 million.
It's at 94 million. The truth is coming out. It's coming off.
That's hilarious. What a story. Yeah. Man, that was probably the funniest moment on Young Investors Podcast history.
Yeah.
That was a great podcast. We had so much fun doing that podcast.
That's definitely the segment of the podcast that has gone the furthest as well, because I put a big chunk of that podcast into a video that I did that has over 100,000 views on YouTube. So that,
wow.
Yeah, I'm sure we got some new listeners from that. I wonder if there is anybody who became a listener from that video. Head over to the YouTube version of the podcast and let us know, because that would be kind of funny.
Yeah, definitely. What a story. That's hilarious. All right, back on to Robinhood.
Mm.
So yeah, current market cap $58 billion. I can't remember what I think it's about $70. Yes. Yeah, true, because we haven't had another trading day. So, yeah, it's still at $70.39. Mm-hmm. It says here in the CNBC article, it is unclear exactly what is driving the stock price higher on Wednesday. Yeah, no, I thought you'd like that.
I think it's pretty clear.
but on Tuesday, ARK Invest's Cathie Wood purchased 89,622 shares of Wood in its ARK FinTech Innovation ETF, a position worth roughly $4.2 million based on Robinhood's closing price of $46.80. Well, it's up more now.
Oh, that's a pretty...
Wow. How's that for a one-day return?
Is that a really small fund? Because that's a... Or do they just have like a lot of... Maybe they have a lot of smaller investments in that FinTech Innovation
ETF. Honestly, not sure.
I don't know. Yeah.
Honestly, not sure.
Because $4 million is not a lot. I presume she manages like over $1 billion. I presume.
I'd imagine. Oh, yeah. This is just one of her many.
They're just one of the funds.
Different ETFs. They got so many different ETFs, like the Space Exploration ETF, like the Genomics ETF and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, interesting. They would have made a tidy one-day profit on that. So, what else does it say? The position added to the approximately 3.15 million shares Wood had bought of Robinhood since the company's debut.
There we go.
So
they own a lot more than the 90,000 shares. That makes sense then.
There's that bit of information that I should have said before that we were just missing.
Yeah, so it's a $200 million position. That makes a lot more sense.
The Young Investors Podcast, guys.
Bringing you the latest and greatest information on real world events.
All I had to do was read one more sentence of that article and all would have made sense. Oh, dear. Anyway, you know, sometimes people hook into us because, you know, this podcast is so laid back. But honestly, that's why I love doing it. I mean, I don't think this podcast, you know, those really well-produced podcasts that are just like, you know, with music and sound effects and stories and interviews, and I don't think we're ever going to be one of those. I kind of just like the fact that it's just a chilled out podcast, and we just chuck in the latest news stories of the week, and we just talk through them.
Yeah, it's like a weekly debrief. We just have a yarn on a number of topics. I think it's
fun. Remember that's what we wanted it to be because we both had no one to talk to about business and investing. So we just wanted an outlet to just be able to talk about what's going on. Anyway, getting sidetracked. Robinhood IPO surging through the roof again. Interesting stat. which we cited a few weeks back on the podcast, 250 IPOs in 2021.
Wow.
How insane is that? It's a lot.
Jeez.
Versus 218 total in 2020.
250 IPOs. What are we, 7 months in? So that's over one a day.
Yeah.
Over one a day. That's crazy.
It's a lot.
That's a lot of IPOs.
And I will just, I will bring everybody back to just a reminder of what the best investors in the world generally say about years where we see huge spikes in IPOs, in that it's a reasonably good sign that the market is in quite a speculative place. Because obviously people that want to take their company public want to do so at the most opportune time where they can raise the most amount of money. And clearly that is right now.
Yeah.
Because there's just money in the market. There's people just willing to throw money at anything at very high prices. And that's why you see so many people taking their companies public. I mean, we should take the Young Investors podcast public.
Yeah. Well,
I reckon we'd clear easy, like maybe a $10 billion market cap, I reckon.
Yeah, something about that, probably.
That's probably on the low side, to be
probably
honest.
Probably go down a couple of percentage points on the first day when we offload all of our stock. and then it'll rally. And then it'll soar. It'll do well. I mean, as the number of IPOs per year grow, that's a really good reflection of the growing number of people who believe that the market is expensive, because that just basically is a direct indicator of people who own businesses who are going from, who need money, or maybe if they don't even need money, but they're not public, and them realizing this market is hot. Now's the time to go. And that progressively increases until there's some kind of correction. And then everyone says, well, let's just hold off IPOs for a couple of years. We can get a bit more money if we wait. So,
yeah, exactly. It's crazy. And who would have thought, you know, Robinhood IPO? I mean, we probably would have thought after 8%, going down 8% on the first day, we probably would have thought, oh, this is a failed IPO. It's going to keep going down. And that just shows you that it's really hard to know what's going to happen when it comes to IPOs. And I think that you'll agree that is why, one of the reasons why we tend not to buy them, because they're very hard to understand what the hell's going to happen with our money. But yeah, that's the Robinhood IPO, everybody. we'll have to come back next week. All right, I'll ask you this. Next week, from this point at $70, whatever it is per share, will the stock price be higher or lower? God. What's your guess?
Brandon, don't do this to me.
I know, like, we don't know. Okay. We've got no idea. It's just funny to have a go.
Yeah. Look, I'd be lying if I said I wouldn't love to see it under the opening price of $38, but I don't know. I mean,
I'm going to say
higher. I think
I'm going to say higher as well.
I wouldn't be surprised. Let's get like a range, like within $10. I'm going to say between $90 and $100 per share.
Wow. I'm going to go bold here. I'm going to say Robinhood will become the next meme stock. That's what I'm going to say. So Robinhood users have used Robinhood to buy GameStop and AMC. So I'm going to say, this time next week, Robinhood is going to be at $150 per share. $150, around $150, give or take, I don't know, $5.
Okay, all right.
That's going to be my guess. And Robinhood will be the ultimate meme stock. They got their reputation as the meme stock provider, and then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and they themselves become the meme.
Yeah. It's a networking effect.
as Elon says, fate loves irony. So I kind of feel like that has a decent potential happening.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, that's enough about Robinhood. Amazon. Talk about Amazon.
Yeah, run us through Amazon earnings.
Yeah. So Amazon had their earnings. To be honest, Amazon is not a company that I know a heap about. I don't invest in it. But I find it quite interesting. It's one that a lot of people are interested in. So sales or revenue for the quarter came in at $113 billion, which is pretty impressive. Yeah, I know, right? Although, I mean, to be fair, that's considering the type of business that they are and how they're selling, you know, they're like a big marketplace, that's to be expected that their revenue is going to be really high, but also their cost of revenue would be quite high as well.
Hmm.
Anyway, sales, $113 billion for the quarter, up 27% year over year. So, if we break it down, they've got a fair few revenue segments. So, online stores, that did $53.2 billion, up 16% year over year. Then, physical stores did $4.2 billion, up 11% year over year. Third-party seller services, so that's other people selling on their platform, $25 billion. So, that's up 38% year over year. Mm. Subscription services, $7.9 billion, 32% year over year. AWS, $14.8 billion, up 37% year over year. And then other, which I think is mostly advertising,
right,
is $7.9 billion, up 87% year over year. So, that's actually growing quite reasonably, up 87%. So, that's almost like you could imagine if that continues growing booming like that, it might end up catching web services, which would just be ridiculous.
Yeah. If it is advertising that's mostly pushing that, I wonder if they'll break that out into its own segment or rename that segment, because the other segment there is the same size as subscription services already. So,
yeah,
you'd imagine if it passes significantly, then they might need to jumble around their names. That's one thing I dislike about growing companies and how they report, is they're always changing their segments. Like Google has changed their segments. They've brought out YouTube now out of the rest of their business, and it just makes it hard to track over long periods of time because the segments all jumble around. Even Disney moved around.
Disney's a pain in the butt.
God, Disney's changed it 3 times now, I think. But yeah, now with the Disney Plus, they've put that into its own category with subscription services. So it's a pain.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Disney's the worst of them. Because it's just like they've got so many parts of their business, and then you can't figure out flipping where they've put each one.
What's
growing? I don't even understand what this means anymore.
Yeah, they hide what's not growing and display what is growing, and then if that changes, they shuffle around. Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah. Anyway. So, story for Amazon. Big growth, obviously. They're all positive double-digit growth numbers. I mean, that's what you want to see.
Yeah.
And that's impressive, because it's also considering Q2 was not a bad quarter for Amazon last year.
Right.
What we're seeing a lot at the moment is a lot of companies had really bad Q2s last year. So, it means that this Q2 just looks amazing.
Yeah, right.
But Amazon didn't have a bad Q2 last year because everyone was locked at home buying stuff on Amazon. So, the fact that they're growing well is quite the outcome. However, that's not the story that the media is going with. They're not saying, well done, Amazon. They're actually saying, Amazon, what's going on? You're slowing down. And that's because last Q2 2020, their results, they'd grown revenue 41% year over year. So, they're going from like 41% year over year growth to 27% year over year growth. And they're going, Amazon, this sucks.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny.
I mean, there's the thing with growth comparisons going into 2021 is, I mean, there's a lot of people who are in two camps at the moment, and we're not quite sure, you know, which is going to prevail. But some people believe, you know, businesses like Amazon, for example, are seeing, well, last year saw a massive uptick in online sales, but that was just because people were in lockdowns and restrictions. And then when restrictions go away, people will kind of, their behavior will revert back to where it was previously. Whereas you have other people who are saying that the pandemic just accelerated the change online, and that people's behavior for buying things online isn't going to go back. It's not actually going to slow down. It's just been brought forward, and it's going to stay at these heightened levels as people realize that it's a much better service. And the performance of Amazon year over year now, some of those high double-digit numbers of growth, is kind of a pretty good indication so far that people aren't just reverting back. It's not like revenues slowed way down or went back to, you know, or went down. And the same thing is kind of being seen with businesses like Chipotle that are seeing still massive increases in their digital sales. That people are not, you know, they were ordering digital last year, and then they're not just going to go back to going into restaurant this year, that they're actually going to continue to order digitally, that they prefer to do that. So, it's all very interesting what's going on with these businesses.
Yeah. And in this case, the CFO did note that, you know, these results were because Amazon experienced that explosive growth as soon as the lockdown happened. So, he's saying, yeah, look, guys, I mean, we had a huge benefit last year, so it is going to be hard for us to live up to that. So, he's kind of confirming that that first that first point that you were talking about there. But yeah, it is just bizarre. It is just so interesting to see because, you know, some businesses now look fantastic because of their terrible Q2s, and there are a select few businesses that, and now the media is going, oh, they're not as good because their Q2s last year were just like amazing. One of those, the most obvious example is Netflix, right? Yeah. Where the last Q2 was amazing. And then this Q2 was not as good because everybody's opening up, getting back to work or whatever. And now everybody hates Netflix again. But yeah, a quote from the Amazon CFO, Brian Olsavsky, he says, we're starting to lap that. And now that's why you see, some of the growth rates coming down. And in terms of outlook, they think this will probably continue. Right. It says, quote, our customers are safe and healthy and ordering from us. And we know that there'll be more vacations or more mobility. There'll be things that probably people shied away from doing last year, but that's all good. But it does tend to lead them to do other things besides shop. So we're just adjusting our run rates in the period that we see that happening. Mm. So I feel like the management's saying, look, guys, yes, we had a great run because of the lockdown, but let's just come back down to reality. We're still posting great growth numbers, but it's not going to be the 40, 50% that we saw year over year in Q2 2020. Revenue growth seems like it's slowing now, but I mean, $113 billion in revenue is not too bad. They also had net income of $7.78 billion, yeah, leading to a diluted earnings per share of $15.12. Now, interestingly, this is where it gets interesting. This EPS number crushed analysts' expectations of $12.30, but it's really weird because they missed revenue, which upset analysts, but they massively beat earnings per share. Mm. And when this happens, it's usually a result, in Amazon's case, of higher margin revenue segments taking up a bigger slice of the overall pie.
Right.
And that's what happened in Amazon's case. So they saw really good growth still in cloud computing, subscriptions, and advertising. For example, Amazon Web Services grew 37%, faster than the 32% growth in the previous quarter. Mm. Advertising grew 87%. Subscription grew 32% versus 16% for online stores, 11% for physical stores. So the revenue, the revenue segment pie, more of that space is being taken up by higher margin parts of their business, which leads to, you know, taking home more profit, which leads to higher earnings per share.
Interesting. Yeah, it is interesting that they didn't meet expectations on revenue, but they beat on earnings. You would think that investors or analysts would care more about that bottom line, about what's coming through, but apparently not. So, yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe it's just the media. The media likes bad news more than good news, right?
Yeah, I mean that is true. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, overall, that is what I had to talk about for Amazon. A couple of interesting things to take out of that. But yeah, should we move on to some Q&A?
Yeah, we should. We're keeping good pace this podcast, I think. We've gone through a bunch of different stories, a couple of earnings. But yeah, we should dedicate some time to going through some questions because, I really enjoy going through these questions that you guys send in. And if you're wondering how you can send in your questions, head over to the YouTube version of the podcast at youtube.com/TheYoungInvestorsPodcast. Click on the latest episode and just leave your questions as comments on the latest episode. Where do you want to start?
You start at the top.
Start at the top. All right. I'll read this one to you. Hey guys, love the podcast. Quick question here. So China has been quite interesting as many stocks seem somewhat undervalued, especially compared to other markets. For a company like Alibaba, would you recommend transferring from a broker like Stake that holds the US version of the stock via an ADR to another broker that holds the Hong Kong version of the stock in case of a Chinese delisting on the US stock exchange? And then also, do you think there is even a chance of it being delisted, or is that all FUD? Would love to know your thoughts. Thank you for all your quality content. Well, thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, thank you for tuning in. This is a really interesting question. And it's. I'm glad we're talking about that this week because we just spoke so much about Alibaba and China before. But yeah, so there's the way these ADRs is essentially like you're buying into the company, but in a roundabout way. So I believe it's like an entity held in like the Cayman Islands or something, but it's listed on the US exchange. So, you know, for people living in the US, they can just buy, you know, the US version of Alibaba instead of buying, you know, the Chinese version of Alibaba. But there, I mean, I can't say I know a whole lot about the whole ADR, how it works, that sort of business. So I definitely encourage you. And I can't make any recommendation. We don't recommend anything. So, you know, make up your own mind, definitely. But I think when it comes to, you know, ADRs, where it's kind of investing in an entity that holds the stock, but the entity is held in the US or it's held in like Cayman Islands or wherever, I think you just have to think, okay, it's just an added layer of risk. So you could, I guess you could hold the Chinese, version, or you could hold the, you know, the ADR version, but I think holding the ADR version, it's just another layer of risk because yeah, you don't know what China's going to do. I have no idea. I can't tell you whether I think there is even a chance of that being delisted. However, the one thing that I will say is that the big super investors, are buying the ADR. So right. Take that for what it's worth, but you know, Charlie Munger, Monish Prabhai, and I'm not sure, but I believe Phil Town and Guy Spear would have been the same. They're comfortable with buying that US version of Alibaba. So take that for what it's worth, but I'm no expert. I can't really talk too much on this.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that question, so I have nothing kind of to share on that.
All right. Well, let me ask you, should I ask you this one?
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
All right. So this one says, hi guys, can you help me understand how I should be thinking about capital lease obligations in relation to long-term debt? I've come across a company that has little long-term debt, but capital lease obligations, and I don't know if I should be ignoring the capital lease because there is a hard asset behind it. I want to know how to build my ROIC for this company. Thanks, brilliant as always. Well, thanks for the question. And for those that don't know, capital lease obligation just means the obligation of, you know, a person as a lessee to pay rent or other amounts to the lessor under a lease or real or personal property. Does that make sense? Under a lease of real or personal property.
Yeah. And I mean, just to give you the short version, I mean, you should certainly be considering capital leases.
Absolutely,
very much in a similar way that you would look at long-term debt. It really doesn't matter that there's a hard asset behind it, like a building or land, for example, because of course you want that business to be able to pay those obligations without having to sacrifice the asset.
Right? Exactly. Yeah.
It doesn't really matter that a retail business has all of these operating leases. If they can't pay those leases, then they're going to lose the way that they produce revenue. So you certainly still want to consider them. I do think about them. Well, I guess I consider them in the same way as long-term debt. In terms of long-term debt, most of the time you'll find that the debt will be due. I mean, at the longest, probably over an 8-year period is kind of the longest you'll see long-term debt held by businesses, sometimes longer, but a lot of the time, actually, you'll see debt that's held that's due in the next 5 years. And that's the way I kind of think about capital leases is you can go into the annual report and there's a section that's called contractual obligations, and it will give you a table of all of the money that they need to pay in terms of debt, capital leases, and any other contracts that they have to fulfill. And it will also show you when the money is due. So how much is due in the next year, how much is due in years 1 to 3, how much is due beyond 5 years. And my focus really is in how much liability do they have in the next 5 years, and can they easily cover that with other assets and equity that they have within their business? That's the way that I'm considering that. But yeah, definitely, definitely need to consider them. And there has been a recent accounting change actually on operating leases that now includes other types of leases on the balance sheet. So it does change around some of your debt ratios, but you still want to consider them in the same way. They're still obligations that the business needs to pay.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. That makes sense. Should we do one more?
Yeah, which one? What have we got? I'll read this one to you. Hey, guys, I'm just wondering if there's any significance into looking at the buy volume of a stock for that day. Why does it matter?
Yeah, so trading volume is just it's essentially how many shares traded hands on a particular day. For long-term investors, I mean, for traders, it probably matters a lot. For long-term investors, I don't think it matters in the slightest. Have you ever looked at trading volume before buying into a stock that's kind of at a margin of safety price?
No, but no. With that said, I never look at really, really small stocks. So that's the only consideration I would think is like if you're worried about is there enough volume to actually buy into the stock for really, really small, low traded stocks? That would probably be a consideration.
That's a good point.
But for what I'm looking at, which is $1 billion companies, what we're looking at, $1 billion companies,
yeah.
No. Because there's always hundreds of millions, billions, tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars being traded. So
what we do ain't gonna matter.
Yeah. It's a very drop in the ocean.
But yeah. But generally you're right, like volume can be classed as for a trader like an indicator of momentum. You know, if the market is or the stock is rising on increased volume, then people like that. When prices are falling on increased volume, then people think, people are getting out. But for a long-term investor, I want to buy this stock and hold it for 5 to 10 years, and it's a great business. I'm much more interested in looking at the business operations and, you know, it's pumping out cash flow like you wouldn't believe. And, oh, what do you know? The valuation, it's now really cheap because maybe the traders have pushed it down so far. Now it's really cheap. I wouldn't hesitate to just buy it regardless of what the trading volume is doing, with that little asterisk with what Hamish was saying before, because there are some cases with like penny stocks. And I think Phil Town talks about this in one of his books, is that one of the mistakes he made early on is he was buying into a small company and he couldn't believe it because he was buying and buying and buying and the stock was just going up like you wouldn't believe. And he was like, oh, I think I'm a genius. So he started selling. And when he sold, the price was just going down, down, down. And that's because he was moving the stock because the volume was so low. But I think for long-term investors, volume doesn't really matter.
No, I think volume on any given day in terms of a long-term investor is kind of the same as a stock price movement on any given day or a stock price movement over a week. For traders, that might indicate some, as you said, some kind of momentum or some kind of other indication. But for long-term investors, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Thanks. That was good. Good fun. Thanks, everybody, for sending in your questions. As a reminder, if you'd like to submit a question, head over to the Young Investors Podcast on YouTube and just find the most recent episode and just chuck a question in the comment section. And that's how we do it. We just gather up all the questions that are in the comment section and then just chuck them into our Google Doc and then we just run through them. We definitely appreciate it. And, you know, you don't have to ask a question, even if you've just got a topic. If a piece of news has caught your attention, feel free to bring it to our attention if you would be interested in having us discuss it, really anything, or if you want to know something about it, you know, anything really, talk about short selling, talk about anything really. But I think that'll do us for this episode. Thanks everybody, as always, for listening. We really do appreciate the time that you give us each and every week. And we hope you get something out of the podcast. I think we've got I really like the podcast following. I mean, I feel like we've just got a nice group. There's like a few thousand of us that just love to tune in and just talk about investing and what's going on. And I don't know. I really like it. I like the podcast. It's a good group. Good group. And we always get great questions as well. But yeah. How much am I rambling right now?
A good amount.
Amount. All right. Well, I better shut up and get out of here. No, thanks very much, guys, for listening in. Thanks, Hamish, for joining me. Thanks to ShareSite for sponsoring. We'll see you guys next week.
See you guys.